You're listening to a sermon by Ken Friesen, recorded on Sunday, September 14th at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Now, the passage that was read out was Romans 14, and that's from lectionary reading. And lectionary reading, if you don't know, and many of you I know are from Regent College, is sort of a cycle as one goes through the Bible. And so, in a way, you don't choose, if you fall to choose the lectionary reading, you don't choose the passage, it chooses you. So I'm in the same way as a lawyer, I don't choose clients, they kind of choose me. And so I'm left with the facts that they come to me with. So Romans 14 is what is chosen, and in a way it makes it easier, and I've spoken a few times here, it makes it easier to grab a passage that, or to go with a passage that is chosen for you, because you come at it with a clear slate, hopefully. I'm going to start talking this morning, talking to people over 30 years of age. With those over 30, try to remember to the point in your life when if someone was a year older or a year younger, this was a significant point of difference. It was significant because so much could happen in that 1 year that could change you and those around you. It is one of the reasons why university life can be so thrilling, such a thrilling point in one's life, particularly for undergrads. Now, this is the Welcome Back Sunday for students, so let me be, from this position, say welcome back, of course, to school, and for many of you to the center, but as well welcome back to what is often a defining point or year in one's life. And we associate with the center and this church hope that your year living here in a Christian community will be a significantly positive experience in your life. And that's what we look at the Mount Simon Center as being, as a chance to live in a Christian community. Now, we... that's somewhat different, but somewhat the same as living in a church community. It's something you grow together over the years and change. For many of us, the academic year is a distant but pleasant memory of a simpler, happier time, a time which has been replaced by an unrelenting taskmaster, the regular calendar year, driving us forward through 12 barely distinguishable work months. In this church, we try to follow the religious calendar, and the chapter, and I was originally going to do a couple chapters, but I only got through, and this is kind of like doing an exam, I only got through one, and that's Romans 14. And there's a chapter in Psalms that was read as well, and a chapter in Matthew. And I know last week that Evan spoke on the chapter in Matthew, and it's not so dissimilar from the issues raised in today's discussion. Romans 14, 1-12 is about living in a Christian community. It was early in the church history, obviously, and there were many divergent views of people, particularly Jews and Romans, with significantly different backgrounds, coming together in a new church community, and one with few traditions. So the beginning of Romans 14 begins, "As the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. One person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains. Let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. For are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand. One person esteems one day as better than the other, while another esteems all days alike, for each one should be fully convinced in his own mind." This question of what one does on a Sunday is particularly alive to me today. I'm coaching my daughter's soccer team, and the girls play on Sundays. Today is their first game. It starts at 11:30 a.m. I'm keenly aware of this issue. As playing sports on a Sunday, it was viewed negatively, and we at one point switched over from Saturday soccer to Sunday soccer, and I did not play. However, we made a deliberate choice for soccer to play for Charlotte to play soccer while still finding a way to attend church. My son, I'm coaching for him too. And I guess the test for today's sermon is whether he plays his video game. Which I did mention he could, but let's see. Romans 14 also deals with, clearly in the first section, a view that you can look at these matters without passing judgment on disputable matters. So what is a disputable matter? What is of serious enough to dispute, serious enough to justifiably drive a church community apart? Or to drive a community of students apart, Christian community of students apart? Let me give you an historical example within the Ethiopian church. The full name of the Ethiopian church is the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewa Church. And I bring this up because I couldn't help but think of this chapter in the context of a case I'm working on. And so I'm going to look at this chapter to a large degree in terms of my job. In my day job, I'm a litigator. And the Ethiopian Orthodox Church in Vancouver are my clients. And they're involved in a dispute within the church, and they've been locked in a fight over ownership of funds raised by the local church community, and they've been in this dispute for about 2.5 years, and we're going to trial in October. Just over a week ago, I was sitting in an examination for discovery, and that's like a deposition, if people know this more by the American term. That is, before trial, you get to examine or ask questions of the other party. And both lawyers are there, and there's a court reporter taking notes. My client was being examined. And so in that process, I sat beside him. And in that process, my job is to object to inappropriate questions or things that I don't like. The action was that started, as I said, over 2 years ago. During the course of these examinations, the other counsel reviewed some documents with my client that would seem to indicate a somewhat inconsistent view or position was being taken by him. The other counsel then, somewhat gratuitously, I thought, launched into exposition how he simply was outraged by the conduct of my client. My job at that point is to object. Object to this outrage. As his outrage, of course, didn't amount to a question. He may have been trying, of course, to get my client unsettled, or he may have, in fact, been genuinely outraged. But trying to stir the pot, I facetiously stated that I was outraged, that he was outraged. I made a series of other derisive comments about his outrage, and before really cashing myself, mostly because I truly believe that this case needs to be settled. And the only way that this is going to happen is if I had the active involvement of the other counsel. The Ethiopian church has a fascinating history, which claims its earliest origins to a royal official who was allegedly said to be baptized by Philip the Evangelist. And that's found in chapters 8 of the Acts of the Apostles. And at that chapter 8 states, "Then the angel of the Lord said to Philip, start up and go south to the road that leads down from Jerusalem to Gaza. So he set out and was on his way when he caught sight of an Ethiopian. The man was a eunuch, a high official of the Queen of Ethiopia, in charge of all her treasure." So I have a vague recollection of reading that one section. That was the start of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And in the course of representing my client, I attempted to understand the background, mostly out of interest, but partially to understand better the dynamics of their dispute. And as I indicated earlier, their full name, and I read it out to you, was the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewodo Church. And Tewodo refers to the Oriental Orthodox belief in the one single unified nature of Christ, a belief that there's a complete natural union of the divine and the human natures into one that is evident and necessary to accomplish the divine salvation of humankind. And this is opposed to the two natures of Christ belief, that is an unmixed and unseparated divine and human natures called the hypostatic union. And I have a test for you, even though people at Regent. Who has heard of the hypostatic union? The hypostatic union was promoted by by the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox churches. And they had, at the time, you had the main groups, the Roman Catholic, the Eastern Orthodox, such as the Russian Orthodox and the like, they were really in communion with one another, along with the patriarchs of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. So you have the Eastern and Western ends. Well, there was a refusal amongst the patriarch side, that'd be your Alexandria, Ethiopian, those sort of communities, to accept the two natures doctrine that of the Roman Catholic. They thought there was one nature. And so there was a council in 451, and there was a decision amongst that group that they're going to separate themselves over this issue. And so thereafter, there was a separation between those churches I talked about earlier, the patriarch group running from Jerusalem down to Africa through Alexandria and the like, from the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox Church. It's never been reconciled, and that was the issue. And, of course, the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church separated themselves later in the East-West Schism of 1054. So it is quite remarkable for an issue that I think three people held up their hands on. So the division between the early Catholic and Orthodox churches we are familiar with from the early church in Africa and Middle East, came down to a convention or council in 451. And there was a dispute as to whether Jesus was being divine and human meant he was of one mixed nature or two. In my 41 years, this issue has never come up. But back in 451, it must have been incredibly important. When considering this issue, the scholars at the time no doubt felt that the difference between the two views were significant not just in their own right, but had implications on other issues within their faith, no doubt. In other words, they were arguing about, and this caused separation, which they never recovered, subjectively at least, and were to them subjectively of great import. We frankly are the same Christian faith as the Ethiopians, and yet this issue has likely never hit our radar. And now when I consider this issue, when I have to read it out loud, that section, dealing with what the differences are, and this had such an important impact upon the church, I have a hard time remembering or understanding what the issue is. Let me give you another example of strife, which is more current in the Ethiopian community, and dispute which I have become involved in as counsel. The Ethiopian church worldwide is involved in a dispute which centers on the support of the current patriarch. And a patriarch is a pope-like figure within the Ethiopian church, but also in other various, in Alexandria, i.e. in Egypt, and part of the Coptic group. For a variety of reasons, the previous patriarch was asked to resign when the communist government in Ethiopia was overthrown by the military regime. After the overthrow, the then patriarch resigned and fled the country. And in his stead, another patriarch from the same tribal group as the head of the military leader, current military leader of Ethiopia, was elected from within the church. This patriarch who had resigned and fled the country had a change of heart, stating that his resignation was obtained under coercion and that he was still the rightful patriarch. And the Synod is a term for the entire Ethiopian church. And the synod is basically is understood to be based in Ethiopia. And it's supposed to have control over the entire Ethiopian church. Eventually, a synod in exile was established with the patriarch in exile, the one who left and resigned, taking up residence in the United States. The military government in Ethiopia is not particularly popular, particularly amongst those who have chosen to leave Ethiopia, which has really occurred in large numbers since the early 90s. And this new patriarch, being aligned with the government, has seen his following outside of Ethiopia considerably diminished. Now, there was an attempt at reconciliation some 2 or 3 years ago, led by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church based in Ethiopia, by the patriarch that was based in Ethiopia. But that was rebuffed. And since that time, both groups have chosen to excommunicate with each other. Now, this controversy has spilled over into every Ethiopian Orthodox Taiwo Church in North America, including the one here in Vancouver. So a battle for control is being waged by the Toronto Ethiopian Orthodox headquarters, which is aligned with the Patriarch in Exile. And they, with a nominal number of supporters here in Vancouver, have made claims of ownership over the assets of the Vancouver Church. The leaders of the Vancouver-based Ethiopian Orthodox Church state they don't want to declare themselves to be against either synod, but would like to maintain a relationship with all Ethiopians, whether aligned with the Patriarch in Ethiopia or the Patriarch in the United States. Disrepute occurs within a church community when it is at war. This is itself self-evident. Hate is fostered when people behave badly and are attributed with the worst of intentions. Indeed, a question is often posed in these situations, in these sort of situations, as to why must one even associate oneself with the church if this is the kind of behavior it indulges itself in. But on the flip side, we have to realize we choose to align ourselves with church for a variety of reasons, and one need not look further than this Christian community that you have chosen to immerse yourselves in. There's too much upside to think that you one can live alone in an island. This disrepute amongst churches occurs often as a matter of course, because its members are, of course, sinners. The church, however, particularly takes a hit when its adherents are regarded as engaging in hypocritical or judgmental behavior. Judgmental, not in the sense of maintaining different views or values, but rather in a sense of exhibiting a condemning spirit. Verse 10, it states explicitly that, "You then, why do you judge your brother? Why do you look down on your brother? For we all stand before God's judgment seat." Now, this statement is a corollary to the statement found in Matthew 7, not to judge, and later in the same chapter, that if we judge, we will be judged using the same standard that we apply to others. And this is somewhat of a unique concept when you think about it, for if all stand before God's judgment seat, we would think that God's judgment would be consistent, and that a standard would be applied. But seemingly that will not be the case if we engage in judgment of others. I don't believe, though, that in our common ethos, our common sort of current philosophical view, is to engage in traditional judgment of other people or other people's views. When I say traditional, I mean a restrictive and judgmental attitude one associates with a legalistic interpretation of the Bible, an attitude that is pilloried in such books as A Complicated Kindness. For those that have not read the book, it was a bestseller 5 years ago, so it may be for some of you. It concerns a Mennonite girl growing up in Manitoba in a religiously repressive atmosphere in the 1970s when there were no disputable items, but rather there was a harsh world of judgment that covered all issues. Now, I too grew up in the 70s, kind of, but this book isn't descriptive of my experiences. And while this sort of writing resonates with many, it is not reflective of what are more likely the sort of issues that trip us up today. Verse 10, I don't think we are immune from. Verse 10 states, "You then, why do you judge your brother? Or why do you look down on your brother?" I think it enticing indeed for those, by training or by inclination, who think critically on issues to look down on others. I described earlier how I interrupted my legal colleague, or some would say adversary, but we're supposed to look at them at all times as colleagues, and began to undermine him and made mocking comments, as it was my view he wasn't playing the game as I thought he should. I think it's particularly enticing when one is in a place like a university setting to adopt a prevailing philosophical or religious worldview. Certain views become de rigueur, both in the fashionable sense, but also in a literal sense as being required by all. And human nature is such that we are loath to go without our sacred cows or golden calf. For some reason, there is a human desire to believe or somehow know with certainty the right side of an issue, where indeed many of these issues could be beyond us. This desire causes us to take sides with conviction, with our assurance that we are right and others are wrong. The verses in Romans 14, 1-12 lay out many differences. Of course, it's not an exhaustive list by any means, but it presupposes there are going to be significant differences in how a person's faith is manifest. And it is not the disparity of views that can be regarded as the problem. Rather, it is assuredness that one's views must be right. Virtually every generation believes that somehow that its generation is somehow more philosophically advanced than the generation that has come before. There again is a certain inherent snobbery that arises in this and causes us to judge our forefathers and find them to be lacking. No group is immune from this sort of behavior. Ultimately, judging is presuming to know God's mind. It is stepping into the shoes of God and therefore defining him, and this is unacceptable. I'll give you two examples of this. Recently in the Catholic Church and the Catholic Bible, the current Pope has taken the unusual step of removing the name Yahweh for use in the Catholic liturgy. This reflects what occurs in the Jewish Church. Traditionally, observant Jews do not voice the name Yahweh aloud. It is believed to be too sacred to be uttered and is often referred to as the ineffable name, or unutterable name. And they often use sort of certain solutions when referring to the name of God or a deity aloud, knowing that the name of God must not be spoken. Why is that? Well, it's because there is a human desire to place God in a box. To name him is to define him or pigeonhole him. To judge for him is to do the same, is to define him. Let me repeat that. To judge for him is to do the same. It is to define him. In fact, even the sentence, a reference to God as him, can be misdefinitional. As I get older, I continue to read passages from the, and when I read passages from the Bible, I continue to be taken by the nuance I find. The more I read, the more I'm struck by the complexity found in the stories of the Bible and of our faith. Let me speak of another example, which is the most concrete example of an attempt to define God. Moses had gone up the mountain to receive the commandments during the time the people of Israel being led around the desert and being fed by manna. Moses had left Aaron in charge, and Aaron was a bit of a politician. Despite the fact the people of Israel were being fed by manna and escaped slavery in Egypt through a series of divine interventions that we're all familiar with, after Moses had been gone a little too long, the people of Israel collectively began to feel that the God that they had trusted leading them out of Israel was too distant, too unknowable. And so a decision was collectively reached to create a more tangible deity. And now, as a kid, I always regarded this account as somewhat far-fetched for a number of reasons. There is the issue of timing and context. It took the people of Israel only weeks, seemingly, to move on from Moses and the Jewish faith. Moses had not gone 40 days when the people of Israel became restless. That the people of Israel were trading their God for this hastily thrown-together ornamental calf made from gold jewelry seems extremely odd. However, in considering the issue now, looking at the historical context, it has begun to make more sense. At the time, people of the various cultures around Israel used icons such as golden animals as the basis for worship quite readily. Putting together something more tangible allowed for a knowable and certain face on God. So Aaron, in his defense, put together a gold calf and created a form of worship that the people had asked for and could relate to more easily. Is God in the form of the people's creation. We certainly won't be seeing any golden calf being created now, but that hasn't stopped every generation from falling into the trap of trying in some manner to own God and to define him. So God says, 1, do not judge, and 2, If you judge, I will judge you using my standards, not my standards, but yours. This brings me back to my clients, the directors of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church group in Vancouver, who are the defendants in their action. The plaintiffs, the Toronto group, believe that that their issues were the sort of line-in-the-sand issues, not simply disputable matters, but ones beyond that, and the plaintiffs have taken court action. My clients, after trying assiduously to find a means of settlement in this matter, have done so to no avail, or are being taken to a trial where they can either defend or they can relent. And so what should my advice be to them in this instance, where their church building fund is being claimed by a small minority group intent on claiming ownership of the funds in the name of the patriarch in exile? It's likely, through all the hearings leading up to trial, the trial itself will lead to a cost of approximately $100,000. Does forgiveness involve moving on and not fighting? In this instance, I'm not suggesting my clients do that. I want to conclude with these comments. God has called some of us to be judges. God has called some of us to speak prophetically to, for instance, speak truth to power. When we do so, we should do so with the greatest of humility and not presume that our understanding of God extends to anything close to what God in fact is. However, while I do not think God has called us to be judges, I do think God has called us to be judges and speak prophetically. I believe God has called all of us to be peacemakers. I think he's called very few of us to be judges or speak prophetically. A church community, or community of Christian scholars, as I'm sure you all are, could do a lot more with peacemakers than they can do with judges. Thank you.
And now, as is the tradition of the